Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, April 15th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, David Griscom of Left Reckoning joins us. Wahoo! And a special guest. A secret special guest will be popping on a little bit later after that.
I wonder who that could be.
Rush is just giving it away. Russian forces appear close to taking Mariupol, the southern port city that's been under fire for weeks now. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh during that. We had an alarm go off. The mayor of the city estimates that at least 20,000 civilians have been killed in the city since the start of the war. Israeli soldiers attacked the Al-Aqsa Mosque over the, not over the weekend, yesterday in the middle of Ramadan, which is a yearly tradition for them. Over 100 Palestinian worshippers were injured. Expect tensions to increase once again as this week. As this attack follows attacks within Israel over the past few weeks. Ron DeSantis has signed a 15-week abortion ban into law, mirroring the 15-week ban in Mississippi that the Supreme Court signaled it would support. The rollback of women's rights is real, folks, and it's happening right now. As the BA2 subvariant percolates throughout the Northeast, Pfizer will seek authorization for booster shots for 5 to 11-year-olds. Senator Dianne Feinstein has responded to the San Francisco Chronicle piece about her declining mental acuity, denying its claims, and says she does not plan to step down. She wants to fulfill her full term through 2024. Again, Democrats need to go on the record here in talking about her decline. The family of Patrick Loyoya is demanding justice after a white officer killed him during a traffic stop. The officer's name has not yet been released, and thus far, no charges have been filed. And lastly, Southern California's unionized grocery workers have achieved big wins in their new contract. Raises of 12% for most workers and more guaranteed hours for part-time workers. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. It is Casual Friday. Hope everyone has had a good week. Again, we will have a special guest joining us. It's AOC. No, it's not.
Oh, there he is!
Okay. Matt just wants to ruin it. Ruin it for everybody.
I thought that doesn't give it away. It might be Steven Crowder.
It could be. But first, we will have David Griscom on. It's a long time coming. Glad he was able to join us for this Casual Friday. Let's turn first to this much-discussed appearance on Tucker Carlson's show. Amazon organizer Christian Smalls went on Tucker Carlson's show last night to discuss the union efforts and the success at the Staten Island warehouse. Tucker Carlson was less interested in the whole union part and more on the how can I use this as an opportunity to criticize Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. This is broken up into two parts. Here's the first part of this interview.
The worker, she's like a modern wobbly. She's the Walter Reuther of our day. And that's why last year she had to stand alongside striking workers at Amazon's Staten Island warehouse. And we're for that because they need the help. But at the last minute, Sandy Cortez bailed on the whole thing. And that infuriated labor organizers who just won a big vote to unionize the Staten Island facility. Now, Amazon is stepping up its effort to crush the union. Amazon has just banned words like union on its employee chat app. Christian Smalls is a union leader at Amazon, and we're happy to have him join us now. Christian, thanks so much for coming on. Were you surprised that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez,
who has said that here.
Repeatedly that she's on the side of the worker against the corporation, wasn't standing with you at the barricades?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it wasn't just her. It was all of them, pretty much. You know, it's not
fair.
You know, I don't want it to make it just between us and AOC because, you know, a lot of them didn't show up. And, you know, once again, we have no ill will against them. We know that whether they showed up or not, they didn't make or break our election. We just had to continue to organize.
So my favorite part of that there is too, he had slipped in before Chris Smalls came on into the condescending high-pitched Sandy Cortez voice, and he sees him, he's like, oh wait, they're a little more ideologically aligned, and so I can't really do the mocking Sandy Cortez thing to him.
He seemed a little embarrassed almost.
Alexandria. I didn't do the switch seamlessly enough.
Well, it's also funny because it's like he'll throw in those little things like Amazon wants to fight the union effort, and it's like he'll say that with as much gusto as he can, and it sounds convincing because what he really wants to talk about is AOC is like a backstabber. But when Smalls wants to make it about that, he's like, we're not going to focus in on AOC.
I know. And great pivot by Chris Smalls there. It was everybody. I mean, let's point out that all the Republican politicians that Tucker Carlson supports are aggressively anti-union as opposed to like not showing up for the Amazon union effort despite being supportive of it. Like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is not showing up there physically, supporting it behind the scenes, has been supportive of it. Should she have done more? I think she should have. But that's the degree of the debate that we're having, as opposed to like the only thing that Tucker Carlson wants to focus on is the, oh, what a hypocrite, what a liar.
The great thing about this is how small is like this is a learning opportunity, and actually everyone can do better, because even on our case, like we weren't paying as much attention to this one compared to other union efforts, and I think a lot of that's because of the institutional unions sort of involvement, sort of being used as a shorthand for what's likely to succeed, and Smalls succeeded.
It's a great point because I do think that was an issue. You know, I think we were focused and keeping an eye on fights with more established unions, as you say. I guess I'm kind of just rephrasing what you said, but this was such a historic victory, and the independence of it is another layer of why it's so important to keep focusing on. But let's continue, because Tucker's going to keep trying to bring it back to AOC.
And we have no ill will against them. We know that whether they showed up or not, they didn't make or break our election. We just had to continue to organize.
Silence.
Yeah, I mean, it's just it's a weird moment because, I mean, I'm on the right. I've never been particularly pro-union, but it does seem like Amazon needs some counterbalance. Like, it's this huge company. The workers have no power, and maybe we could, I don't know, share a little power with people who work there. So that's my view anyway. So tell us where you are in your organizing efforts.
It's not his view.
Well, right now, you know, we're fighting for a contract. You know, Amazon's disputing the election results. So we're in walking and chewing bubblegum at the same time. We're fighting for a contract. We're preparing for another election in 2 weeks on April 25th. We're going to be voting at a second location directly across the building that we just unionized. So we're in the thick of a fight right now, you know, a legal battle. And, you know, we just have to stay grounded and pretty much begin our campaign all over again.
I mean, you'd think that Amazon would be open to a union, wouldn't you?
No, you wouldn't. All right, here's the other part, because he's lost at this point. He tried to make it about AOC right off the bat. He's a little bit, he doesn't have his moorings here. This is the second part of the interview. Let's just play a little bit more of this.
That Amazon would be open to a union, wouldn't you? It's a very progressive company.
No,
why do you think they're trying to thwart you from organizing?
This sort of like Some people might like say, and certain things that maybe it is good that Tucker like said them into, like just share a little bit of power with the people that work there, right? Like that. Okay, I think that's generally good, but this sort of thing is misleading his audience still,
yeah.
Where you set the like as if it's like because the underlying narrative Tucker wants to protect is that woke corporations mm-hmm. and all the CEOs are like woke. Folks, Democratic Party supporters.
His conflation of cultural elites that are talking down to yeah. you with actual monetary capitalists.
Like, these are capitalists,
and his way, and he that's how he hides the ball and protects exactly. capitalist interests. So he's having a bit of a trouble doing that. You know, undergoing that project here with Smalls.
Progressive company. Why do you think they're trying to thwart you from organizing?
Amazon hasn't been unionized in this country since the beginning of its existence, and they're very anti-union. You know, yeah. they created a system that hires and fires people. They created a system that they have full control of the working people. And you know, having a union obviously brings representation for the workers that'll benefit the workers at the bottom, like myself, hourly associates, entry-level workers that don't get the right to negotiate. So forming a union gives us the right to collective bargain with the company, form a contract to protect ourselves. So that's exactly what we're trying to do with the Amazon Labor Union. We're hoping that we'll be a catalyst for something that'll take place nationwide.
Well, I certainly am rooting for you. I mean, maybe if they throw some more woke slogans at you, you'll forget woke you can't slogan. Feed your family.
Right.
Christian, I appreciate your coming on. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you, Pat.
Right.
Right.
That laugh.
Maniac. No, I mean, like, but that was expertly done by Chris Smalls
he's,
there.
He's great.
And he did not take the bait. And I think, you know, him, there are still going to be people that critique him going on Tucker Carlson. And for the most part, I don't agree with, you know, going on Tucker Carlson to not be combative with him. But Chris Smalls is an organizer. He has a narrower yeah. set of goals than like a pundit or a politician.
Or a media critic.
Or a media critic, right? This is somebody trying to raise awareness and keep up the pressure on Amazon. You've got to do that from multiple sides. What I'm annoyed about is that there was a group of people of our peers that made this about AOC. Someone like in the media, someone like Tucker Carlson said, I'm taking notice to this. You know, this is why I have Jimmy Dore on. It's the same kind of thing. This is the same way I can use it as a wedge issue for the left. And he saw that as a way to he thought this was going to be an easy way to divide the left and capitalize on this. And another thing, too, is he was hopeful that there's a second, you know, a part B. In addition to, like, maybe we can divide the left when it comes to AOC, maybe we can divide the left when it comes to Chris Smalls. Because, you know, if some sections of the left are just going to focus on the fact that he came on Tucker Carlson to talk about this, then we create infighting. And that...
Which is a problem. I'm sorry.
It's a problem.
Like, that I don't begrudge anybody who's like their beat is media criticism if they want to like say like, hey, Tucker's really bad and blah blah blah, right? But as far as like the general left, like the idea that you got to trust like these organizers, and when you get victories like this, you just have to like allow people, especially when it's led by workers themselves, you just have to let them like go and let them do what they think is best. And I think like Chris Smalls would like basically rewarded people if they would have gave him the benefit of the doubt there, because this was a great because we can need a little bit more confident about when the issues are good issues, right? Because Tucker tried to make this about
yes.
the AOC thing, but fundamentally it's about Amazon trying to coerce and control their workers.
And frankly, Chris Smalls there showed a lot more gumption than a lot of people who go on there who feel peer pressure when you're on a national television stage to cave into that kind of framing because it's easier to get along and you want to bring your message, you know, you want to get your message out there and you want to be able to have a back and forth with the host. And he refused to take the bait. And that's a lot more than can be said for a lot of other people who've been pushing this narrative constantly. And Tucker Carlson thought he had an easy layup here as an opportunity to use this to go after AOC, go after the left as well, muddy the waters on who stands with unionizing workers in this country. And Chris Smalls did as best as he possibly could do in those circumstances to make that not happen.
And I'll just say, like, in all this sort of agonizing about this discourse and how, you know, divisive it's been, this is what Chris Smalls has been saying the entire yeah. time. That's what he said on MSNBC. It's a marathon, not a sprint. And again, like, everyone can do better. I think that people just need to have, this is why, like, I support something like Ben Burgess's thing, even though people get upset with him about, like, going on Rogan and stuff like that, is I think you need to actually appear and get out there if you can. And especially if you've done something like Smalls has done, you've earned it like threefold.
Yeah. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, but first, a word from our sponsor, Sunset Lake Cebede. Sunset Lake Cebede and Majority Report are teaming up to turn everyone's favorite stoner holiday, 420, into a fundraising opportunity for the Innocence Project, a great organization working to undo the damage of the war on drugs. Here's how it works. Visit sunsetlakecebede.com starting Wednesday. So that's already passed, but it's through next week, through April 24th, up until midnight. You can visit sunsetlakecebede.com, and Sunset Lake will be offering 40% off smokables like hemp flower, pre-rolls, and keef, and every other product will be 30% off. I mentioned this. I'm like, I basically take the tincture every night to help me go to sleep. I like the natural flavor. It's quite helpful. Perhaps I need to start getting some of the keef so I can mix it in with anything else I might be consuming as well. That's my next goal, and maybe I'll be using this excellent opportunity, this 40% off, that also goes to a good cause. Sunset Lake Cebede will be donating 4.20% of sales to the Innocence Project, a nonprofit organization that works to free the innocent, prevent wrongful convictions, and create fair, compassionate, and equitable systems of justice for everyone. Sunset Lake Cebede is a majority employee-owned business that donated more than $26,000 last year to anti-drug war organizations, animal shelters, union strike funds, nature conservation, food shelves, and refugee resettlement organizations. Again, visit sunsetlakecebede.com to take advantage of these discounts and help Majority Report raise money for a great organization. The sale ends April 24th. Check it out. Sunset Lake Cebede 420 sale. No promo code is needed. The products are already discounted on the website, but help Majority Report and Sunset Lake not just, you know, sell some great products for 420, but also help out the Innocence Project here, which is an excellent organization in this country. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll be joined by David Griscom. We are back, and we are joined now by David Griscom, finally, of Left Reckoning. Good to see you, David.
It's a real pleasure to be here.
Oh, yeah. It's a casual Friday, so we'll get to cover a wide range of topics where we can make fun of right-wingers and Elon Musk, because that's what I want to get to.
Yeah, we corralled Griscom in from the honky-tonk.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, you're no longer in our backyard. I mean, like, when did you move to Texas? When was that? Like a few years.
Well, I'm from Texas, but yeah, I rolled back here during the pandemic, basically.
Yeah.
I've been with my partner for about 10 years, and pretty much every week, and I've been asking her to move to Texas with me, and she finally said yes, so we did.
And you just jumped on that opportunity.
Oh, of course.
I mean, I get it, right? especially in the pandemic. But since you are in Texas as our Texas correspondent, I'm going to ask you to talk a bit about this Greg Abbott stunt. So, yeah, for people that aren't aware, Greg Abbott has been shipping buses, or sending buses, I should say, of migrants to blue cities, to Washington, D.C., as a way to say, you know, this, you deal with it now, you deal with them now. And now he's been disrupting, I guess, the supply chain along the border by stopping these trucks and vehicles. And even members of his Republican administration are starting to get pissed off. But it's hard for him to walk back from this because this is a big part of his, you know, tough on immigration stance. What's your sense of how things are going for him on the ground, and what's your response to this stunt?
Well, they're not good. I mean, let's start with the busing. You know, this is one of those things that I think you have to remember that Abbott uses the position of the governor here as a political theater. And he, you know, he's very willing to do a lot of stuff that's very disruptive, but this is pretty exceptional. And this, the stunt first of sending people to Washington, D.C., you know, he's copying off the notes of Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz proposed something like this in October in Congress, and it went nowhere. No one was really interested in it. So now a few months later, Greg Abbott tries it. And yeah, I mean, like, I think there are some people who like it as a, you know, maybe symbol or something like that. But the Republican Party here has been really hitting him hard on that. Alan West, who ran against him on the right for governor, called it a stuck-on stupid position. And mainly, you know, them all being Republicans, what they're most upset about is the money that's basically going into this busing program. I don't know. I mean, on that, I think it's disgusting to use people as human props. Though we have seen some of the interviews that have come out from people saying, like, well, I had never really intended to, like, stay in the Rio Grande Valley. So this is great. I was trying to get to Miami and I'm a little bit closer. So
free ride.
Yeah, basically. You know, so he's basically had to, I mean, not with that, but he's basically been getting a lot of pushback from folks, which I think has really backfired. And I think the most material bit, though, is what he's been doing with the supply chain. If I could break that down, it's because it's actually really crazy. So Abbott has been having state troopers inspect commercial vehicles that are coming over from Mexico. And I'm sure most people are aware a lot of trade comes over from Mexico on a daily basis. And this has caused huge snags in the supply chain, hours upon hours. I think it's important to remember, too, that while there's the bureaucratic nightmare on the U.S. side of the border, truckers in Mexico have staged protests to basically say, we're going to shut down the border, too. And oftentimes that has been sort of overshadowed. So we want to shout those people out for using their labor power to make a point. But, you know, the Far Reynosa Bridge alone, like $70 million a day of goods are coming across that border. Mexican agencies have been saying around $8 million a day has just been lost in all of this kind of madness. And a significant amount of trucks are now just rerouting around Texas. You know, they're going to other ports of entry in Arizona. You know, and it was almost immediately a disaster politically. Sid Miller, who's the agricultural commissioner here, came out, and he was one of the first people to really hit Abbott hard. Sid Miller is, you know, is a Republican, but has a very weird relationship with Abbott. Apparently, Greg Abbott hasn't returned one of his emails or phone calls or even had a meeting with the agricultural commissioner of Texas in 7 years. And of course, when Abbott's response to Sid Miller's basically criticizing his policies that Sid Miller doesn't know what's going on. Well, it makes a lot of sense if you're not responding to emails from one of your important Republican, right, you know, members of government. So, I mean, just to fast forward a little bit. So this has been going on, like Beto, of course, has been showing up at the border and has been making, rightfully, you know, trying to draw awareness to this. But what Abbott's now doing is he's trying to save face. So because this has been so unpopular, and the thing about this, too, is like if you're in Texas and you might have not experienced this at like the grocery store yet, but it's coming, and they're saying basically this weekend is when you're going to start seeing empty shelves. You're not going to be able to get fruits and vegetables, or
it's
at least
communism.
They'll be.
It's communism.
Well, it's big government getting in the way of free enterprise, right?
Obviously.
You know, so there's a lot of pushback against it already, and I think it's only going to get worse. Greg has tried to save face. He went down and he negotiated with the governor of Nuevo León and got very, very vague promises from the governor that there'll be some more border security initiatives in Nuevo León. For people who aren't familiar with the kind of geography of, you know, the Mexican side of the border there, Nuevo León has a very important port of entry with Texas, but it's actually very, very small. It's a tiny little sliver. So we're still waiting to see if other states are going to show up. So Chihuahua, yesterday afternoon, they also negotiated a deal, but Coahuila, as far as I know, there's been no deal. And the most important one, at least when it comes to, you know, fruits and vegetables and things like that, is Jesus Christ, is a Tamaulipas.
Okay. Way better than when I attempt to like read an IM in Spanish here on the show. So don't even worry.
They still have not, as far as I know, negotiated, and that's going to really hit a lot of the agriculture here. And I don't know, it's been a really interesting week, frankly, to see the kind of pushback from even within the Republican Party to these kind of stunts, to see how willing Abbott is to sort of do stupid shit like this, so that he can try to bolster his national image. And that's the thing you have to remember too, is he's doing this, I think, with presidential ambitions, and he wants to go like his goal right now is to be, sitting with Tucker Carlson or Sean Hannity and being able to say that I'm the real, tough on the border guy. There was a segment on Fox News, where they compared him, they called him the Ron DeSantis of Texas, which I don't think his team very much is going to appreciate. So, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how much, benefit he gets out of this, but it's really been an absolute disaster.
Yeah, I mean, bringing up Ron DeSantis there, it's interesting. There's no way he can catch up to, like, the media darling treatment that Ron DeSantis has gotten, especially because DeSantis is, way more ahead of the curve on, like, some of these cultural performative stunts that Abbott has not ever seemingly been able to capture. And he's been in office for a longer period of time. Mm-hmm. What are we thinking if he does run for president? Tops 3% in the polling?
Yeah, I would be surprised. Him as a national political figure is interesting because, I don't know how. I mean, liberals probably get, worked up about him as a kind of villain. But, even the way that he runs the state here, there's a lot of stuff that really should, like, Abbott really wants to be a kind of big media figure. And he tries to play this kind of hardball stuff, but internally in Texas, he's been quite effective, promoting an extreme conservative, far right form of government. Not only that, and this is something, if I can make a quick plug, I'm writing a piece for Sublation Media, coming up in a few weeks on what Greg Abbott's done to the office of governor here. Because, people might not be familiar with the way the system works in Texas, but Texas has historically been a weak governor state. For a long time, governors were only elected for, to office for 2 years. And the executive power of that office is historically extremely weak. It's sort of fragmented into different elected boards or appointed boards, and things are staggered, so you only get a few appointments. So typically that's been a weak office and not really something that, people aspire to who had, grand designs of power. But following in the footsteps of Rick Perry really started to reformulate the government and create a kind of like clientelist system because he was in power for so long and that sort, and he inherited a lot from Bush. But Greg Abbott has used the COVID pandemic in a really fascinating way because a lot of people who, get worked about, vaccine mandates and all this stuff, they're saying it's the government's coming for my freedoms. The government's trying to extend its power. But what Abbott has done is he has declared a state of emergency since the beginning of the pandemic ongoing to today, right? Which might sound surprising to people who are living here where there are, you very rarely see a mask or anything like that. The government very much acts here like COVID-19 is not, still here. And Abbott has used the, emergency powers that he asserted at the beginning of the pandemic to basically wage war on all other sources of authority in the state. While I don't know about his presidential ambitions, he has fundamentally like reshaped, the way the system of government in Texas works. And, it's not really one of those things that comes up at the top of the headlines because it's very slow and methodical. But it's going to have very long-term consequences, especially if the Republicans are able to maintain power here.
Yeah, I mean that I was unaware of that. Although it does, it, based on his political career prior to becoming governor, it, like he's always been an ambitious and aggressive politician. So that does make sense. If we could just go back a little bit to the border thing, yeah. I wanted to ask more about these deals that he's trying to broker with these governors in Mexico, because it's so performative to me. I mean, is there any teeth to this as opposed to him just saving face? Like, you know, it's more like, I won't disrupt the supply chain coming out of these areas in Mexico, but you have to really promise me you're going to get tough on this illegal immigration stuff. Is there anything more to it than what I described?
That's been pretty much it. I mean, you know, firm details have been pretty slim so far. So it's these kind of vague promises of, you know, ramping up border security on the southern side. And look, you know, for him, you know, he just wants to have the photo op. Where he's like, look, I negotiated hard. They had to come to Texas to negotiate with me because we're powerful. They're not, right? He wants to flex his muscle on the international scale so that he can really work up his base. And like, you all, people also need to remember that, like, in the complete absence and dysfunction of the Democratic Party here, that all that's going on politically is a contest between, like, you think Abbott's right? See the guys who he ran against, you know, in this most recent. You know, in this most recent Republican primary, Don Huffines, who y'all probably even maybe played him on the show because he's a very ridiculous kind of super far right character. He said during the campaign that he would shut down all trade with Mexico, right? Which everybody absolutely ridiculed as a disastrous kind of policy. And here we are, Abbott, after sort of smoking everybody out in that GOP primary, now we're having these kind of policies come into play, right? So, like, there is a the people who are being listened to in Texas is the more right-wing members of the Republican Party. So that's who he's trying to placate. And, you know, I don't want to be too geographical about this, but, you know, it's East Texas a lot where Abbott is really trying to shore up more support, because that's where you started to see some more of those push for these other kind of, you know, candidates who are running against them. So, like, he's trying to play a game for those folks, too. And, like, you know, it's putting us all at risk.
Yeah. And you mentioned the Democratic dysfunction there, or like the inability for them to gain a foothold. This Beto O'Rourke campaign is so depressing. I saw a few days ago, he was criticizing Biden for ending Title 42, not even immediately. It's going to end in a few weeks. The pandemic era, basically blanket policy that turns away almost all migrants who are seeking asylum at the border. It was a Trump-era policy implemented on shaky legal ground, and the Biden administration kept it in place for quite a while. And anybody on the left, anybody center-left, is critical of this. Was critical, I should say, of Biden continuing to violate people's right to seek asylum and keeping Title 42 in place. And then you have Beto O'Rourke saying, it was kind of hasty to get rid of this Trump era anti-immigrant racist policy. Like, what kind of freaking campaign is he running as he talks about, I'm going to take your guns away, and also I'm going to go to the right of Biden on immigration?
Yeah. Well, I also just wanted to note there, too, just on Abbott and like how he's using his powers regarding COVID. I mean, Title 42 is a great example of this, right? They're not worried about COVID for us, but they want to maintain that kind of policy on the border, right? It's just like, it's very clever how they're trying to secure power. But I mean, the Robert O'Rourke campaign has been very funny. he's been, I mean, you know, in fairness, his Title 42 statement was something along the lines of, I think Title 42 should be gotten rid of, but they need to be coming here and supporting us, which is not a defense of Robert or of Beto's, you know, position, because it shows this kind of like mealy mouth, both sidesism that he's been doing. And, you know, on guns, I don't know too much about the, you know, the concrete details, but now he said, well, I'm not I don't want to come for anybody's guns now, right? And he's even played up that he's like, I like to shoot sometimes, right? So you're seeing this like two sides to him that is very different than, you know, for example, his Senate run, which really, you know, shook up, you know, politics. I mean, people thought that he was the rising star here. And then he went on his insane campaign to be the president of the United States, which nobody was particularly interested in. He's running, he's a small business guy now. He keeps on talking about, I think he owned a graphic design firm for 10 years or something like that. So he's been talking about how he knows how to run a small business, which, you know, it is what it is. You know, a lot of kind of selfie line stuff, you know, taken from the Warren playbook. The one thing that he's done that I said from the beginning that he needs to focus on is to come at the grit, because that was an absolute disaster.
Yeah.
But you know, I think there's a lot more play to be done there. So I hope that that's the direction that it goes. But it was a really cynical thing that you were hearing people here say that, you know, Abbott is basically banking on this, the winter storm that came here this year, not being as bad as last year's, which shows how bad the state of affairs are in Texas politics, where we're some kind of like, you know, we're like looking to the stars to select our next governor. If we have a bad storm, you know, then we get rid of them. If it's mild, we don't. But you know, there's a lot of stuff, I think, on the campaign regarding like the environment and, you know, the grid that Beto could be hitting at a lot harder. Obviously, he's been saying that we need to come at the people who made billions of dollars, which I think is good. We need to be connecting to the national grid. But also, we need to get rid of this for-profit system, which just creates an absolutely ridiculous incentive to, you know, jack up the price of electricity. We need public power in the state. We need a Green New Deal. We need a just transition and like a real buy-in from labor, oil and gas workers here, which I haven't seen as much from Beto. He's taken some things from the AFL-CIO here, but I think that he could be doing a lot more. But yeah, I mean, like he's wanting to do two things. He wants to do culture war politics, basically. And then these kind of both sideism, things on things like Title 42, on guns. I don't know. I haven't seen too much to be particularly inspired.
Well, the gun thing is what bothers me more about that is like, okay, that's not a serious campaign trying to win in the state. And you can have your own personal opinions about that. But that is what that's designed to do is to be a Jamie Harrison type campaign where you get a ton of outside money. You know, when he was trying to unseat Lindsey Graham, you get a ton of money from outside of the state, you know, suburban coastal donors are going to love the, you know, we're going to seize your guns rhetoric or the swearing on cable news, and they'll send you money, but there's no seemingly targeted focus on actually winning. And that's what bothers me about this from the outside.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he supports a $15 minimum wage, which is good. Right. But honestly, that's becoming a position that's becoming more and more mainstream in the Democratic Party. And I think a $15 minimum wage floor is not even enough. Right. I mean, people also need to understand like the Biden playbook is being used. Like his first campaign was interesting because when he ran for Senate, it was interesting because he tried to throw away the Democratic Party playbook where they're just going to go in their kind of safe areas. And he went everywhere. And, you know, he's continuing that kind of track record, but you can see in the sense of like where he's, you know, he's going around the state, but you can see that the focus is suburbs of Austin, suburbs of Dallas, suburbs of Houston. And I'll tell you this, it is a foolish strategy from the Democratic Party because they saw some success in those areas.
Yeah.
That they think that those voters are going to be loyal to you in the long run. People in that class were upset with Trump's, you know, antics primarily, and then they voted Republican down ticket. You know, so thinking that that is where you should be focused, I don't, you know, I think that that's a kind of a foolish strategy. I don't know. And also, like, the campaign itself, it already feels retro. Like, people are putting up their Beto for Senate, you know, things on their front lawn again. And it's just like, you know, it's been 4 years since then. You know, he burned so much goodwill in the state, Emma, I can't tell you, by running for president. People were pissed.
I get it. I mean, he could have parlayed that into what just laid low, ran for governor, or ran against Cornyn. I mean, that could have been a real opportunity for him. Instead, his ego got massive.
Born for this.
Yeah.
Yes. And I mean, you know, there's so much that really, you know, needs to be done. I mean, I guess some things, you know, just so it doesn't seem like I'm ragging on him too much. You know, he has come out for Medicaid expansion. I think that should be a more focal point of the campaign. You know, Texas led the country in rural hospital closings before, you know, from 2010, 2020. But because of extra federal money, because of COVID that was going to these rural hospitals, a lot of those were able to stay afloat, right? And remember, you know, when you have a Medicaid gap like you do in Texas, that means a lot of people, they go and they get help and then they're unable to pay. So those hospitals don't have, you know, any kind of income, right? There's a lot that can be done, I think, really on the rural healthcare arena, because these boys don't care. The Republicans do not care about the health and safety of rural Texans. And that's a huge opportunity. I think that it's not being taken advantage of right now.
Absolutely. I don't want to, even though that was excellent, stay on Texas the whole time that I have you, because I just looked at the time. I spent more on that than I thought, but it was really interesting. Good stuff. Thank you, David. Let's turn to the events in your former city here in Brooklyn. Obviously, you watch from afar as... there was that terrifying subway shooting, and the response from Eric Adams and the NYPD in particular has been, we talk about Beto O'Rourke's campaign being retro. This is like retro tough on crime, Giuliani era politics. Mm-hmm. And they're boasting the NYPD about having apprehended the suspect, who clearly had some severe mental health issues. And the reality of the situation, and Eric Adams is trying to parlay that into some anti-homeless person stuff, even though the suspect was maybe potentially targeting homeless people. We don't know that for a fact, but he's had some anti-homeless rhetoric as opposed to rhetoric against other ethnic groups. But this resurgence of the tough on crime rhetoric, as well as the NYPD trying to take credit for when the guy left his credit card on the scene, he called the cops on himself and they showed up too late, and then he was finally actually apprehended by a Good Samaritan. Like, there is this narrative they're really trying to break through, that this is why we need more police funding, this is why there need to be more cops everywhere. What's your take on what you've seen out of New York this week?
I mean, it's, you know, first of all, we need to be getting money to our boy, Zach, you know, the guy who actually apprehended him.
Just so people know, I tweeted out a link. He posted some, like, you know, donation thing, buy him a cup of coffee. Go to my Twitter feed and you'll find that link. Nice. I'd encourage people to give him some cash.
I mean, this is, it's... I mean, the shootings themselves were horrible. And of course, you know, Adam, this was inevitable in the sense of, like, it didn't matter what event was going to trigger this. They were waiting for something like this to say, we need to bolster, you know, the police department funding in New York. I mean, the police department in New York is an army, frankly. It has more than enough funding. And this is something that I don't think, you know, is going to be isolated in New York, that, you know, we're going to start seeing more tough on crime Democrats, because, you know, over policing communities is one of like, if you're a neoliberal, you know, mayor of a city, it is probably the easiest and cheapest weapon to use to sort of, you know, stomp down on social problems and discord that comes when you have an extremely unequal society like you do in New York. You know, so it's like, I can't imagine that this will be isolated in the sense that, like, I think that there's going to be mirrors of this in, you know, cities across the country that are run by Democrats over the next few months and years.
Can you talk a little bit about the Austin experience on these issues, Dave?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, so Austin early on, they cut the police budget. It was on a referendum, and, a group called Save Austin Now, which pretended to basically be a nonpartisan group, but just happened to have their offices located in the Travis County GOP's office, really mobilized suburban and wealthier voters to start showing up to, you know, kind of off schedule elections where there's typically lower turnout to do things like, so Austin, had implemented, you know, they weren't arresting people for camping in public, and Save Austin Now put forward this really ludicrous, camping ban that was even worse, than, you know, what happened before. Save Austin Now was basically able to like garner all this kind of, you know, suburban and wealthier support, to come in and implement one of the most harsh and cruel and barbaric, you know, anti-homeless laws in the country. What was interesting about that is that almost immediately after, they came out with another bill that was overwhelmingly, shot down because they were basically trying to tell the city how to allocate funding, in the city of Austin. And people reacted really negatively against it. So I don't know, you know, what lessons other people can draw from this other than like, you know, there's a lot of opportunity for the right to have backlash. But staying organized and staying mobilized, can also, you know, push back against a lot of these groups that are really trying to use any kind of social crisis, you know, to bolster police funding and, you know, strengthen the carceral state.
Well, it's like, it's the shock doctrine. It's that kind of, you know, any opening that, these tough on crime folks are going to see, they're going to take, even if like the actual details of the story, like we're seeing here in New York, don't justify such a response. They bank on the emotional reactions of people in order to push through whatever they want to do. And saying we'll make you safer through this funding of police or through more cops, it doesn't matter if the evidence doesn't support it. There's a segment of the population that without organized pushback, as you say, will buy into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it, you know, I mean, like it relies on a kind of common sense. It's wrong, but like a common sense understanding that if the budget goes up, that crime goes down, but it doesn't. I think, you know, this is one of those things where people who consider themselves to be progressives or on the left, you know, really need to, you know, be pushing back because the moment that, like, for example, like defund the police started becoming mainstream in the Democratic Party, you knew that that kind of movement, was on its, you know, last breath because they were going to take that and, you know, implement it or not implement it, but, you know, sort of be associated with it in a way that they were then later going to have to say, well, we tried it. It didn't work. You know, what we have to do is increase police funding. I mean, you know, Adams is the poster child of that kind of backlash, right? Yeah. I mean, somebody who has deep ties with the police department. Yeah. I mean, I can't tell y'all, you know, what's going on there. I'd be curious to see, you know, what the next couple of weeks are going to look like in New York as he's starting to, you know, take advantage of this moment to bolster his police support.
Right. Absolutely. With that said, I can't let you go without ripping into Elon Musk.
Our boy.
Yeah. So
our cyber cowboy.
Jesus. I mean, I don't even... That's like too cool of a name. You're pulling it. We have a clip for this, right? I think we do. Okay. Yeah, let's just play this
from
clip.
from Elon's TED Talk yesterday.
Yeah. Elon, for people that don't know, Elon Musk has publicly announced that he wants to buy Twitter for over $40 billion and take it private. And independent analyses of the cash that he has on hand have shown that he does not have nearly enough money to do that right now. It is a transparent way for him to pump and dump the shares that he has purchased in Twitter. But it also gives him some sort of PR cachet with right wingers who are mad at Twitter for banning Donald Trump, for violating their terms of service. But here he is talking about how lies, they really get his goat. He's in favor of the truth.
So that was a really strong statement. I mean, obviously, a lot of people who support you, I would have thought, would say, you have so much to offer the world on the upside, on the vision side. Don't waste your time getting distracted by these battles that bring out negativity and make people feel that you're being defensive. Or, like, people don't like fights, especially with powerful government authorities. They'd rather buy into your dream. Do you like? Aren't you encouraged by people just to edit that in that, you know, temptation out and go with the bigger story?
Well, I mean, I would say, like, you know, I'm somewhat of a mixed bag. You know, I mean,
well, you're a fighter, and you don't like to lose, and you are determined that you don't. Basically, I mean, you are
sure. I don't like to lose. I'm not sure many people do. But the truth matters to me a lot. Really, like, sort of pathologically, it matters to me.
I'm very different. I'm unique and different from other people, and the truth matters to me. So, like, Elon, tell the truth. Do you have the liquidity to buy Twitter and take it private right now, or are you just trying to artificially bump up your share price before you sell, and mm-hmm. you don't have any real intention of purchasing this major company in and of itself?
I mean, the truth's really important to this guy, unless, you know, you're somebody out here talking about the workers' rights violations that he's been, you know, accused of in California. You know, the truth really matters to him. He's somebody who loves to make big statements. I mean, did you see the Starlink thing in Ukraine? You know, so he says, oh, I'm bringing internet to Ukraine. And everyone's like, oh, thank you, Elon. Elon's saving the day again. And turns out, it's a completely unfeasible solution because you have to have these like $700 modules. And, you know, it's hard to implement something like that in normal conditions, right? If you're to bring a bunch of modules so that people can, you know, have access to internet, let alone in wartime, right? And it's just like, he's an amazing character because he really does rely on like the kind of Twitter brain, frankly, where it's like everything's happening in an instant and there's no follow up. So, you know, maybe it'd be fitting for him to get in at Twitter, but I don't think he's going to be able to buy it. I mean, he's been basically throwing a tantrum since the board, you know, denied his first offer.
Yeah. And he says he loves the truth so much. And yet he bristles and gets really pissy when people bring up the fact that Tesla in particular has benefited greatly from government subsidies. But he doesn't like that to be a part of the narrative. He wants to be, you know, perceived as this upstart electric vehicle company. No, I didn't get any government help. I'm a principled libertarian and free thinker.
No, this guy has been cradled by the government from the get-go. From, you know, early help with Tesla. But two, I mean, even look at what he's doing right now, you know, by moving, you know, the headquarters of Tesla over to Texas and building this new gigafactory. Why did he do that? Well, I know Greg Abbott would like to say it's because he's, you know, here because he loves Texas, you know, Texas values and that Texas moves. What was the phrase I used? Texas moves at the speed of business, right? Yeah. It's like, no. Elon Musk came here because his facilities in California are facing lawsuits for like the most extreme racism I've seen from a major company in my lifetime, right? You know, where they were having black employees cordoned off into certain sections of the factory that they were calling the plantation and a few other words that I just don't have the heart to say right now. On top of all of that, which is bad enough, extreme, you know, worker rights violations and for the, you know, the green future poster boy, extreme environmental damage that has been done around those California factories. So he realized that he was going to get in trouble from the government of California. So he found a new benefactor to come here, you know, to protect him. And that's Greg Abbott and the Republicans who are allowing him to, you know, run over this state, damaging communities from right here in Austin to South Texas, where he is basically, you know, has one of his goons, mayors down there. In Brownsville, who has been harassing a young activist and threatening her with jail time over opposite because, you know, over allegedly some graffiti. And the mayor says, you've also posted a lot of anti-Elon social media posts, right? I mean, like, it's really frightening. But the point is that, like, this guy who says, like, he's not involved with the government sure loves being able to use our system when it gets giving him money. Sure loves being able to use, in that case in South Texas, the strong arm of the state. I mean, he's a... He's full of it, and I wish I didn't have to see his face very often, frankly.
No, I know. But he's insistent on being front-facing. And I just want to point out that the speculation about the pump and dump stuff with Twitter, he's done this before with crypto and NFTs. So this would be very much within his playbook, and using the publicity that he creates for himself and that Atlas breathlessly report to his advantage monetarily.
The question is probably confusing to Elon, though, because it's like this: getting into these high profile fights is exactly what that's sort of his main job.
Yeah.
That's what he does. Like, and remember his sort of he's pathologically, he seeks truth when he accuses a guy of being a pedophile on Twitter. because this guy that was trying to save some kids underwater, I forget where this was, but he declined Elon's offer of a submarine, saying it was a publicity stunt. Then Elon went in and called him a pedo guy on Twitter, and then subsequently created a new type of free speech, which is called the J-Dart, which is you can joke about something even if it's slanderous like that, and if you delete it right away, it's just a J-Dart. So thanks, Elon, for that pioneer in free speech.
Yeah, it was that Thai cave rescue in Thailand.
Yeah, I mean, this is somebody who, I think it's worth noting again, he derives a lot of personal value from the share price of Tesla, not just to his personal fortune, but Tesla is a company that does not really produce very many vehicles. So why is it valued so highly? It's all speculation. And when you're operating in that kind of world and speculation, being able to control a media narrative is very, very important. And I hate to give him any praise, but he at least is very good at giving people of overpromising constantly and seemingly never getting in trouble or having it catch up with him.
Right. It's very much a symptom of the idolatry of the tech genius as being vision first. We'll figure out the logistics later.
Yeah.
But the vision, it's so amazing. And you can fix all these social problems through capitalism with just this one different kind of looking billionaire.
Yeah. Or look at the self-driving cars, which have been killing people across the country.
Yes.
Right. The thing is, people are like, well, Elon Musk is an innovator. And, sometimes you have to, break a couple eggs to make an omelet. But literally, it's not that he invented this kind of technology. He was plenty of other tech companies have been trying to work on self-driving cars. But almost all of them said, we're not going to take the risk to our brand and to human life to put these out on the road until we are certain that they function properly. Elon Musk is the kind of guy who says, we'll just take the risk. And
right.
I've learned my whole life that I'm not going to get punished for any of this kind of activity. That's the innovation that you get from Musk, right? Taking advantage of government spending and then trying to, don't ask, what is it? It's better to ask, forgiveness than permission kind of mentality to his business, which is super dangerous when we're talking about people's damn lives here.
Yep. Well said. David Griscom of Left Reckoning. Check out Left Reckoning. Of course, we always plug it with Matt, but this is the other excellent voice that you'll get on that program if you tune in there. So thanks so much for your time, David. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Emma.
See you, David.
See ya.
See ya.
All right. With that, we have our special guest with us. Do we? Fresh-faced. Yeah, we're ready. Here we go. Oh, look who it is.
Hi, guys. I'm alive.
You're alive. Yay.
I'm alive. Yeah. Here I am.
Are you going insane?
I'm going a little bit insane.
Have you been recording podcasts just to keep in the habit?
I've launched an entirely another show. It lasts only 3 minutes and then it just breaks down into a coughing fit. And that's basically it. It's my hook now.
Is that how this is going to go, this appearance? We'll see.
I say that up front because although today I seem to have a little bit more stamina with this type of thing. So I've been able to talk to people on the phone and it's been great. But it's been a rough week. Really just want to I want to thank all the kind words that I got on Twitter and Emma. You've done an amazing job. I wish I had my soundboard.
Thank you.
Holding down for it. And Matt and Bradley. It
makes me uncomfortable to know that you've been watching.
Well, I didn't say that. I've just heard. I've heard really good reports.
There hasn't been any major problems yet to deal with.
I've dipped in, but the first couple of days were really super rough, and it was weird. I said this on Twitter. I Friday night, I guess a week ago, I started feeling like nothing that I would have considered any type of like symptom, except for in retrospect, because I always feel like I have a symptom of something. Mm-hmm. I always feel like I'm about on the verge of break, you know, getting some type of cold. But Saturday morning at about 5 a.m., I woke up and because I felt like I had like the beginnings of bronchitis, which I hadn't felt in years since I smoked, really, because it used to be every time I would get a cold, it would just be a chest cold. And I took a I took a test, rapid test at like 5 a.m., negative. I took one at noon that day, negative, you know, and I was around Saul. Milo, of course, was out of the house immediately as soon as she woke up. So I never saw her practically. And Milo had a big show at Carnegie Hall Saturday night. Aww. And I was starting to feel progressively worse. And they say, if you're not feeling well, don't come. But I'm like, I keep testing negative. I went and I got a PCR test, which at the same place that she had gotten, like a rapid one. And you got to pay out of pocket for that now. And it's expensive.
How much was it?
It was like $140 Jesus. Or something like that. And that was for like a much longer turnaround time. But I found this place that if you go, I guess it's just so slow now that I got it literally within like an hour and 15 minutes. So by 5 p.m., I had a PCR on Saturday that also said negative, but I felt really crappy and had baseball the next morning and saw, you know, with Saul. And so we decided we would go because it was going to be a late night, which was a drag. I woke up the next morning, tested again, negative. Went to coach some baseball, and afterwards I basically just was like, I can't do anything else the rest of the day. And so I was in bed for all of Sunday, which ended up being good because it meant like I wasn't in direct contact with the kids. Saul went and, you know, had two other things that day and had people, you know, pick up the slack for me. And I don't think I tested again that day, but Monday morning I tested and I think it was Sunday. I wrote you guys. I was like, I got this bad cold. I had, you know, and I don't like to miss work, but it Sunday night and Monday night were overnights were horrible. My throat, I've never had a worse sore throat. Woke me up every like hour and a half. And it's now I basically am just tired. My throat is more or less fixed. My voice is still a little strained. I think you can hear that. And I got a little bit of a tiny bit of a cough, but it was no joke. It was rough.
Do you think that like you started feeling sick earlier on because you had your fourth shot?
I do. And that's very speculative, but I think so. I certainly think the onset of symptoms came quicker because I was like double boosted. And that's why I was testing negative. There was some study out of Chicago. It's not been peer reviewed, but they found with healthcare workers that being boosted actually separated. You got your symptoms earlier because your body is reacting as soon as it senses that COVID is around. Mm. Even before you have a viral load that can
transmit.
And so I think that's why it's unclear to me whether I got it from Saul because he's been sick or whether I got it at a restaurant, but nobody I was with at the restaurant got it. And it wasn't a very terribly crowded restaurant. So it's almost not clear where it came from.
That's weird. And you tested positive on Monday.
I tested positive 7 a.m. Monday. Yeah. I could have tested positive later in the day Sunday. I just didn't. I didn't test because at that point, like, you know, three or four rapid tests and one PCR test into it. I was like, I don't have it. But then Monday morning, I was like, I better try this one more time. And I think, I mean, you know, in that sense, the vaccine probably inhibited me transmitting it asymptomatically because my symptoms came so quick.
Right.
My body was so ready to recognize that there was a virus there. And this is all, you know, this is speculation, but I've spoken to, I've traded some emails with Mark Elaine Derry, the epidemiologist we have on, you know, occasionally, and been doing a lot of reading on this. So, but it was no joke. It's amazing. Some people get nothing. Larry Murphy, who I think people know, we've had on the show a couple of times. He had a very similar experience to mine in terms of like the throat thing. So
Night onset thing sounds very familiar to my experience too. Like I would be not fine during the day, but just a little bit lethargic. And then at night it'd be like my throat would
much worse.
Yeah. It's very strange.
Yeah. Much worse. Like I could feel it starting to come on at like 7:30. I went to bed one night at 9.
Wow.
I haven't done that. I don't think I've done that since I was like
childhood.
7.
Yeah, you have sleeping issues. Something I can relate to. That almost sounds like getting COVID. That would be the one silver lining of it. Is you go to bed early for me.
I've been doing a lot of sleeping.
That's nice.
Oh, the other thing too that we should tell people is that next week is my planned vacation.
I know. Which is not
going to be necessarily as interesting as we had originally hoped. It was never going to be terribly interesting, but I will also be out next week. But by the time I come back, I'm going to be like so fit and healthy and
oh yeah,
5-hour shows.
It's going to be exactly. We're going to have.
That first show back is going to be...
We're going to go till 5.
Yeah, it's just like, I better stock up on some food. Lots of cashews here for me.
Yeah, exactly.
Although I doubt I'll be doing a ton of talking because you'll just be ready to go.
I'll be raring to go. So Elon Musk, huh?
Yeah. We didn't... that was really more just like the dessert at the end of our chat with Griscom because he was keeping us updated on this Greg Abbott performative border nonsense.
Did you guys talk about the fact that who is his number two?
Ken Paxton.
Yeah, Paxton was basically saying, you know, we successfully interfered with trade. Like, that's not.
Do you want to do a clip, Sam?
Sam, do you want to do a clip?
We have it.
Oh, you have it?
Are you well, up for it?
Yeah, let's do this clip. I mean, my understanding is that there is a there's a federal government and state governments in this country, and that the federal government, even all of those libertarians who think that income taxes are illegal because Kansas didn't have an actual quorum for its state legislature in 1916 when they voted on it or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. They all seem to agree that the Constitution says the federal government should be dealing with international trade. Let's play this clip.
Joining me right now is the Attorney General of Texas. That is AG Ken Paxton. AG Paxton, it's great to see you this morning. Thanks very much for being here. You know, the governor was explaining last night on Tucker why he is inspecting commercial trucks. I guess in response to questions that the White House was saying that his moves to send migrants to Washington is affecting trade. Can you explain to us what's going on at the border?
Well, good morning. Yes, this is genius by the governor. We basically have a tacit agreement between the Biden administration and the cartels. And the way it works is the cartels know they can transport humans and drugs across our border. And the Biden administration will pick up those people and move them around the country. It's a tacit agreement. The cartels know the deal, and they're profiting greatly. The governor has figured out we can stop trade along the border, slow it down, and it will create pressure on Mexico and some of their governors to work out a deal to help us with border security. So he is doing what the administration won't do, which is protecting the citizens of Texas, protecting the citizens of this country from drugs and from human trafficking.
So in other words, look, he's saying to Mexico, if this doesn't stop, we're going to slow down the trade because we're going to be inspecting all of these commercial trucks. Has it worked?
Yeah, I think he's already got, as a result, I think he's already got agreements with at least one or two of the governors. And I think that you might see more of that as we go along. It's effective because you hit the Mexican government and their pocketbook and everything.
He has agreements with one, and like Griscom said earlier, that border crossing is like one city wide, and then that's like, as we know, Texas has a much larger border than that.
Right, and then there's also the issue of it's illegal.
Yeah,
for
the
you
Constitution
to be inhibiting international trade into this country. You're not allowed to do that. Like, if I wanted to, I would imagine. I'm not sure who has standing in this instance, if it's like the attorney general representing the federal government. But seems to me like that interview right there is going to provide, you know, two big pieces of testimony as to what the intentions and what the impact of this this move by the Texas government is doing.
Yeah, Merrick Garland seems to be like purely ceremonial in that role, though. I don't know if he's actually going to go after anybody.
Does he actually go out and do any ceremonial things, though, either? I mean, is he even there? Do we know that
no.
he even exists?
He's a figment of our imagination, yeah.
I'm starting to suspect the reason why they don't hold hearings for his Supreme Court seat is because he only exists in our minds.
Yeah. We're all Merrick Garland.
This also bolsters that idea that was floating around for the Canadian trucker thing, that the right's interest in that was to F up the economy.
Yeah, right.
Like, it's a very similar sort of pattern emerging from this.
Well, David was saying they're anticipating that there's going to be like empty shelves and food shortages just starting over the weekend because of this, like, you know, ridiculous stunt. And now Abbott has to backtrack and go and make it seem like he's still the kingmaker, that he's like working with these governors in Mexico. You know, we'll allow trade now, but you have to agree you're going to be tough on immigration, right? Right? It's just an effort for him to save face because he's violating, it's like Article 1, but Section 10. That's what I read today, that you can't, no state can make a deal with a foreign power on trade. It's pretty clear.
Has the Supreme Court overturned Obergefell yet? Or is that we waiting another week or two before that happens?
I think it's still pending.
Well, the only other thing I want to say was I wanted to make a point of saying it. I meant to say this up front, that this is the most analog illness I have ever experienced.
Yeah. What does it feel like?
Analog. Totally analog. Does no one get that joke?
Like vinyl?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like vinyl. It's not a great joke. People already
heard it. I don't know if the audience is going to be familiar with like that very niche comment by Max Blumenthal on the Jimmy Dore show.
Oh, all right. Well, yeah. But should we play this clip? I like Max as a person. I haven't really followed his work in the way that I used to years ago. I mean, I thought the work that he did in covering, you know, the way that Israeli society was treating Palestinians was very strong. And over the years, I've interviewed Max, and even as late, I can't remember the last time it was, but I know like when we were in Vegas at one time. But so I haven't really followed a lot of what's going on. But this is really was
sad. Almost.
Both. Very funny and then sad and yeah. and
it seems like he'd been working on this concept for a little while, and then Jimmy just shoots him down.
When you got COVID, Didn't it feel digital?
I don't know what you mean by
it. It feels digital. It just doesn't feel like anything else when you have COVID.
To me, it felt like I got Omicron, and it felt like I didn't get Delta or the first one. So I got the most mild version so far. I think I even have the last version of Omicron. And it was like I had the sniffles. It was like nothing. I wouldn't even mention it to people if we weren't in the middle of a pandemic. And I know I had COVID because I got tested. So I wouldn't even have mentioned it. So to me, it didn't feel anything except like the mildest flu I ever had.
I mean, when I had it, it wasn't bad or threatening in any way, but
see, pause, right? Right. So that's what it is. He
so you got to do a little fidelity to the narrative.
Back. Yeah. Because Jimmy's whole thing is it's just a mild cold. It's not a really big deal. And when you start getting into COVID,
what is
actually
Max's, what
5G?
Is Max's thing? Is he, that's is the, he,
that's what's confusing. Cause Max, like, Max really, in my opinion, lost it when he had those guys were saying like we need, who are now saying like we need to give businesses reparations because of the lockdowns, and the lockdowns were actually more harmful than COVID. But like now, I don't know what he's saying, because the thing that gels with what Jimmy's saying, which is that this is just a cold and it doesn't matter. Get back out there, teachers. And this is like, oh yeah, I'm not saying it's threatening. It's just digital. Like, it's just entirely foreign and new, but it's not threatening, Jimmy.
Let me just say this, too, that, like people should understand the concept of two people can get the flu, and it can really impact one person more than another. I mean, we have people who die during flu, and I'm only using flu because flu is not as loaded as a virus at this point in our country, politically loaded. But two people, three people, five people can get the flu, and it can hit them all in different ways with different severity. Like I say, when I go on Twitter and say that, you know, I had the worst sore throat of my entire life, I heard a lot of people come back with the same thing. Larry Murphy and I had a very similar impact. I know there are people who have had COVID, and I don't know which strain I got, but, you know, we know that the latest variant seems to be at the, that it's, you know, sort of like has taken over in New York State anyways. But I am aware that there are people who get it who are in worse shape than me after.
Some people experience like a Tron-like universe when they get it, apparently.
Right.
I mean, I had one day where I was a little bit like dizzy and this and that, but for the life of me, I've never heard anybody ever refer to any physical malady as being digital. Digital to me in this context, and let me just be generous for a minute, okay? And and think that he actually means this. That means binary, right? Digital is you're either getting the signal or you're not getting the signal.
A series of ones and zeros.
Right. And analog is there can be intermittent stages. And it sometimes it's worse, sometimes it's better, and like that. I don't even understand, based upon him saying it was completely mild, that what it means to be digital. You know,
maybe he just got Havana syndrome and didn't get tested and was confused.
I mean, the only other answer is that he is knowingly trying to do a hoax and goes on and realizes like, oh, Jimmy's not going to play along on this. It would be the most, I guess, heartening thing to hear that really what they've been doing is their version of birds aren't real. Like that would be honestly like that, at least I would be like, okay, they didn't quite pull it off in the same way, and it's not sending the same, you know, sort of like satirical message. But at least it would be, I mean, if they're just going for the straight grift on this, it's just super,
I don't know.
He's
signaling to the 5G conspiracy theorists, right?
Of course.
Yeah. But I mean, it's also just not coherent though, because that's supposed to be the vaccine that's given you the digital reaction and it's making you a cell phone tower.
But they also have been pushing, you know, the idea that COVID itself is fake or has been created. What? Yeah. Or that maybe it's transmitted by the vaccine itself.
Mm.
Right. We've heard about lab leak, but we didn't hear about like hard drive leak theory, that maybe this was made on the hard drive somewhere and just escaped into the bloodstream.
She bleached it. She bleached it all but the COVID.
I told you, you need bleach bit because...
I like how Jimmy, it's really
I find it really depressing and sad. I really do.
Jimmy tries to get off of it too, though, because it's his channel and he knows how to walk that, like, I'm not going to get demonetized line. It's calling COVID some sort of, you know, Microsoft Office software might be a little bit too far for the YouTube, the executives algorithm.
The anti-vax. And of course I use that, I know that I think they both have gotten vaccinated. But I got the news for you. That does not mean that you're not playing to anti-vaxxers for your TV show. In fact, it doesn't make it better that you have availed yourself of the vaccination, yet you attack the foundations of what vaccinations are in terms of public health policy. Well, particularly when you're talking about a communicable disease.
It's why I left the left, right? It's like I was a part of the vaccinated population, but now I see why it's actually really dangerous. That's what they're trying to do.
Yes, and they're also conflating what the term anti-vax means. Anti-vax does not mean that you are against taking a specific vaccination. Anti-vax means that you're undercutting the entire concept of what vaccination means when you have a communicable disease in terms of public health policy. The idea that you cannot, that there is a secret vaccination court is not so secret. It's been around for I think at least a couple of decades. You can Google it and you can find the records of what's been paid out. And the reason why they do this, outside of the normal judicial civil procedures, is because for vaccinations to work when it comes to communicable diseases, you need as much uptake as possible. And the way that public health policy is done is that there's a certain amount of risk with every medical procedure that exists, including vaccinations. You're always going to have, if enough people get that procedure or that vaccination or that drug, you're always going to have a number of people who are going to have adverse reactions. That's why there's no medical procedure that is 100% safe.
Yep.
And to undercut the idea of just that vaccinations, broadly speaking, are safe and that our vaccination system is really, we know the outcome of that, but I was really surprised by that. I mean, Jimmy Dore, I don't put anything past him. He's so you know, deep into a bottle half the time, he doesn't even know what he's saying. But I was really surprised to hear that from Max.
Did you appreciate the stand up? Last thing, stand up bit at the anti-vax rally. What's your thoughts on that as a failed stand up yourself?
My stand up never quite got to that level. I was always trying to work my neck isn't smiling Botox joke.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot of iterations of that one. I could never really pull it off. So it's a tough joke to pull off.
Eyewire act.
It is, you know, there's nothing better than doing an industrial like that, where it's all you got to do is, as long as you bring out your best, your even if your anti-vax material is like grade D, you're going to get some good responses there. It's just that they didn't like hearing that he injected himself with Botox. That was the problem, because right. It involves a needle.
Yeah.
So
scary. Needles are scary.
Guys, I've hit my limit.
Mm.
I'm going to go back.
That's longer than we thought, right? You thought it was like 5 minutes.
I'm surprised. Thing. I couldn't help myself.
And two clips.
Yeah, I'm not surprised about that.
There you go. No.
I feel proud of myself about that.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for your warm emails and tweets. And don't forget to push the Boston show.
Oh yeah, the Boston show.
Yeah, the big live.
All right, I've been forgetting to do that all week, so I'll do that next week when you're also not here. People are going to
majority
forget about
live,
you.
Folks. Boston yeah. show, check it out. All right,
feel better.
I'll see you guys later. Have a great week.
Bye, Sam.
Another great week. Too. Thanks again.
Feel better.
Good job, yep, Emma.
Of course. Thanks.
All right, bye.
Back to me.
Yeah, the one that matters is me. I'm the only one that matters.
All right. With that said, should we head into the fun half? What a special guest. Sam just wanted to thank you all for the warm tweets. No, but seriously.
Warm tweets,
though. I'm glad to see he's doing better.
Yeah.
For sure. All right. 646-257-3920. I don't know if we'll be taking calls, so we'll see. We'll see if we get to a few. See you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority
Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who? What is up, everyone?
Nomi Keen.
You did it.
Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this, 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? This me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm gonna go start
life. Libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I wanna say. 857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You call it satire. Sam goes satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.